Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palka reporting. Five women shot and killed in Afghanistan. Afghan officials say gunmen have shot dead six government workers, including five women in southern Kandahar province. The early morning attack occurred when unknown assailants ambushed and sprayed with bullets a minivan transporting the female Kandahar airport security staff to work. The deadly attack also left the male driver dead. No immediate claims of responsibility for the violence. A spokesman for the Taliban denied its involvement, saying the Islamist insurgency has nothing to do with the attack. An agreement was reached Saturday to resume the evacuation of Syria's eastern Aleppo. The evacuation was suspended Friday due to demands from pro-government forces who wanted two additional villages evacuated. Residents of the villages will be included in Saturday's exodus, which has yet to begin. The Syrian government suspended the evacuation Friday after blasts and gunfire were heard in Aleppo. Both rebels and government forces accused the other of breaking the fragile ceasefire agreement. A car bomb has exploded next to a bus in central Turkey, killing at least 13 soldiers and wounding 55 people, most of them soldiers. Six are in critical condition. The blast in the city of Kayseri destroyed the bus carrying off-duty soldiers. The attack took place near the campus of a university. An average of 20 migrants died on migratory routes every day in 2016, far surpassing numbers from previous years, according to the International Organization for Migration. More than half of the nearly 7,200 deaths counted this year occurred in the Mediterranean Sea on routes to Greece, Italy, Cyprus, and Spain, according to a report released yesterday by the IOM. The significant increase in deaths in the Mediterranean is particularly striking because the overall number of migrant arrivals in Europe has declined sharply in the last year. This is VOA News. Speaking at his final news conference of the year late Friday, President Obama stressed that Americans cannot let themselves be affected by Russia.
This is part of what I meant when I said that we've got to think about what's happening to our political culture here. The Russians can't change us or significantly weaken us. They are a smaller country. They are a weaker country. Their economy doesn't produce anything that anybody wants to buy except oil and gas and arms. They don't innovate. But they can impact us if we lose track of who we are. They can impact us if we abandon our values.
The U.S. intelligence community believes Russia hacked the Democratic Party during the presidential race to favor Republican Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. Michelle Obama says the White House needs a grown-up, and that the nation will come to appreciate her husband, President Barack Obama. In an interview with Oprah Winfrey, set to air Monday night on CBS, the First Lady said her husband made the country more hopeful.
Now we're feeling what not having hope feels like, you know. Hope is necessary. It's a necessary concept. And Barack didn't just talk about hope because he thought it was just a nice slogan to get votes.
The Obamas campaigned aggressively against Donald Trump in favor of Hillary Clinton, possibly thinking a major U.S. aid package had been terminated. An enraged Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte said goodbye to the U.S. in retaliation today and threatened to dissolve an agreement that allows U.S. troops to visit the Philippines. The Millennium Challenge Corporation, a U.S. government aid agency, did not actually cancel the aid, however. The agency instead deferred a vote on the renewal of aid for the Philippines, subject to a further review of concerns about rule of law and civil liberties in the Philippines. Manila's been one of Washington's chief Asian allies since the two sides signed a mutual defense treaty in 1951. Russia, Pakistan, and China will hold the next round of three-way counterterrorism talks in Moscow on December the 27th, primarily focusing on turmoil-hit Afghanistan. Russian ambassador to Islamabad, Alexei Detov, said Afghanistan is worrisome because of a lack of three crucial elements. That's a stable, self-sufficient economy, good governance, and a strong army. Having the world at your fingertips through the internet was touted as a revolution in education. But a new study suggests internet in the classroom is linked to poorer test scores. Writing in the journal Psychological Science, researchers say the trend of lower test scores was seen even with the most intelligent and motivated students. Even when the students used their computers for class-related work, it did not help their scores. Joe Palka, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Kabila's second and last term in office comes to an end on December 19th. So we are discussing the arrangements that should be put in place so that we are able to manage the country.
The Democratic Republic of Congo opposition members discuss a transition process as President Kabila's second and final term is set to expire Monday.
Well, what I guess the thing is that Nana Akufo-Addo will have to examine the character, the content of the individuals that he wants to appoint into various key positions to assist him.
The Ghanaian president-elect Akufo-Addo comes under pressure from civil society groups to form an all-inclusive government.
If among you there are those of you who are good at shooting, I am giving you an authorization now.
And South Sudanese President Salva Kiir instructs the police to shoot any criminals. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A leading member of the opposition party coalition known as the Rassemblement is urging the Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila to reach an agreement with the group, step down, to allow a smooth transition. President Kabila's official second and final term expires on December 19. Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or ACONGO in the local Lingala dialect, told me the opposition leaders are meeting in the capital Kinshasa to decide the country's transition process and the next steps forward.
President Kabila's second and last term in office comes to an end on December 19th. So we are discussing the arrangements that should be put in place so that we are able to manage the country peacefully until we get to the time when elections could be held. We've been in this discussions for the last several days, and they are continuing here in Kinshasa.
But a court has ruled, effectively giving him the mandate to lead a transition. Are you setting aside the court ruling? Aren't you usurping the power of the court?
In this particular case, as the opposition, we don't believe that that ruling is appropriate. And that's, in fact, the reason why we are here. As you can see, the majority or the president's political alliance is talking with us. I think it's the recognition of the fact that that ruling doesn't have sufficient force to allow him to continue staying in power when his term comes to an end on December 19th.
The U.S. government has urged both the government and opposition to cooperate fully and in good faith with the DRC's Conference of Catholic Bishops to finalize an inclusive agreement as soon as possible on the holding of elections, parameters for an interim government, and a peaceful transfer of power. What is your take on this?
That's exactly what we've been doing. We've expressed time and again our full support to this initiative of the bishops, and we feel that it's the most appropriate framework, and we're hoping that we'll be able to come to some understanding and agreement with the government on the way forward for our country that would eventually prevent the total sort of collapse of administration and life in this country beyond the 19th of December.
Will you renew your commitment to nonviolence and redouble your effort to reach an inclusive agreement acceptable to all sides with the government, if I may ask you that?
No, we've never been a violent opposition. I think the Rassemblement is essentially a political group that is committed to seeking peaceful solutions to the problems facing the country, and we're not going to change that. But it is important that the government understands that this is a country that is committed to moving forward on the democratic front, and because we believe that that is the institutional framework that you need to be able to operate an economy that is performing, that is bringing back confidence investment and jobs to the population of this country. The government definitely is, as we know, as we see it, on the wrong course. And I think it's important that this be reversed as soon as possible. It's going to take reaching this agreement. It's going to take the president and his political allies agreeing to respecting the constitution of this country, agreeing to the fact that the president is reaching the end of the second and last term, his second and last term in office, which means that essentially the time for him as the head of state has finished, and he has to facilitate our transition from here to the time when a new president will be elected, so that you know, the country can normalize its economic and political life.
You talked about you holding discussions with the government team. Are you satisfied with their cooperation so far? Because it doesn't appear that President Kabila is willing to relinquish power anytime soon.
Well, that's unfortunately you know, what we all can see. And I think it is important that the president begins to understand that this country needs to move forward. And this is the effort that we all are making around the bishops of this country to try to find a peaceful settlement to this huge crisis that the country is going through.
So what's next for the Rassemblement?
What is next is simple. We're hoping that we'll be able to reach that agreement with the president and his political allies so that the country can move very quickly to the new, to the elections, and therefore, you know, the coming and swearing in of the new president. We hope that this can be done in 2017. And I think if we are able to do that, we would have solved most of, you know, the problems, the political problems that we have in the country.
Freddy Mbuyamo Mutungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party. He spoke with me from Kinshasa. The chairman of Ghana's Opposition People's National Convention, or PNC, says it is regrettable that civil society groups are pressuring President-elect Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo to form an all-inclusive government. Akufo-Addo from the New Patriotic Party, or NPP, will be officially installed January 7 after winning the December 7 presidential vote. Bernard Mona told me Ghanaians appear to have confidence in Akufo-Addo's economic policies and promises.
Well, what I guess the thing is that Nana Akufo-Addo will have to examine the character, the content of the individuals that he wants to appoint into various key positions to assist him to actualize the programs and the policies that he campaigned on. And to that extent, if Nana Akufo-Addo finds somebody or a collection of persons from other political parties that are worthy of serving in his government in order to actuate the vision that he set for the nation, one cannot prevent it. In the past, for the PNC, we've had people appointed into the Kufu administration from the People's National Convention. We call Honorable Moses Zaniba, worked as the deputy minister.
There are reports that some market folks, business people, Aboso Kai spare parts dealers, have sharply reduced their wares or the products that they deal in spare parts, in goods and services, in solidarity with Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo's win. What is your take about this phenomenon?
Well, I think that it is a sad commentary for our nation and particularly for the business community. Because prior to election 2016, the same business community, particularly the informal sector in Accra, Agogoshi, and other places, have lamented and complained about the unfavorable business environment that they operate in. And therefore, they claim that their businesses were running out of space and that importers were suffering. They also claimed that foreigners were crowding them out of the market system and many other factors. So it is strange that just because elections are taking place, the same businessmen and women who were complaining that things were difficult can suddenly find that their businesses are booming and that they can reduce prices in response to the change in government. What I can infer is that these business men and their group stand only for one political party. They don't stand for the best interest of our nation. I am sad by this development, but I would say that the NPP must be careful about these kind of businessmen, because if it is for their perfidy, they will reduce prices, but they will find alternative ways of ensuring that they rake in the money. Will that lead the NPP to, for instance, not taxing them or asking them to pay taxes appropriately? If that is what the NPP is going to do, then I think that the business community is going to shortchange our nation.
What is next for your party, the PNC?
We will reorganize. I think that is early days yet. All of us have admitted that we had some difficulties going into the elections. Recall that when our presidential candidate and the PNC were just about gathering momentum to go for elections, the Electoral Commission unduly disqualified us. It took us off the campaign. It reduced our logistical mobilization and ensured that effectively we didn't have space to go out anywhere to campaign. By the time the courts granted that the Electoral Commission should readmit us, it was virtually too late. It was left with 3 weeks for us to embark on a national tour, which was impossible for us to do. That certainly affected our ability to lead our nation. And I think that at the end of the day, the PNC suffered a colossal damage. I want to suggest that in 2017 onwards, the PNC will regroup, will work hard, and see how we'll be able to reposition ourselves. Fortunately and graciously, I received calls from Pastor Tindu asking us to see how we can position ourselves as an alternative. If my sensing is right, that means that we should begin to think of rallying the Nkrumah front. I also got a call from the presidential candidate of the Convention People's Party, Ibok Nathrisus, who was asking me to link up with his national chairman so we can see the way forward. So these calls for me are calls that I welcome. And when I return to Accra, we'll begin to rally ourselves to see if we can position ourselves as a formidable and compromised control in the alternative in Ghana politics.
Bernard Mona is the chairman of Ghana's Opposition People's National Convention, or PNC. He spoke with me from the Guinean Upper West Regional Capital, Wa. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has instructed police to shoot any criminals they find stealing. Speaking at a police graduation ceremony in the capital, Juba, the president said he will promote any security officers who kill criminals because of the rise in criminal activity across the country. But Juba residents expressed mixed reactions. While some think the shoot-to-kill order will reduce crime, others say the order is illegal and will lead to the killing of innocent people. For VOA, Michael Atit has more from Juba.
Addressing more than 800 police officers at Juba Stadium yesterday, President Kiir said crime rate in Juba and elsewhere across the country is alarming and something must be done about it. Speaking in Arabic, Mr. Kiir urged newly trained officers to stop criminals in their tracks, saying, if meet a criminal and they resist arrest, shoot them with a bullet in the head.
If among you there are those of you who are good at shooting, I am giving you an authorization now over the people who snuck women's handbag on Bada Bada, and many of them died actually because of this act. I authorize you, if you see such criminals, shoot them immediately.
In Juba, it is not uncommon for some youth, commonly referred to as Toronto boys, to ride through the street on motorbikes and snatch bags and other items from unsuspecting pedestrians or motorists. The president reminded the newly sworn-in police officers that they were recruited to protect citizens and apprehended criminals. Camus Mursal, a 36-year-old resident of Juba from Kato residential area, welcomes Mr. Kiir's shoot-to-kill order to police. Mursal says the crime rate may drop across the country. Mursal says many of his friends have lost their belongings to robbers and thieves.
Without a real and serious action against the criminals and the people that they are, say, looting people, killing people in this country, without any serious action against them, we are not going to survive. So we need just, I want to thank the president for this, and this is a good step from him.
Juba resident Grace John disagrees. She says the new order means police officers have the right to take the law into their hands, which will lead to the violation of other rights.
If the leadership of the law enforcement also, or the law implementers, have taken the law into their hands in a way that it's not right, it will also implicate the country as far as the human rights is also concerned.
29-year-old Lillian KG says a youth riding on a motorbike grabbed her handbag 2 months ago in Juba. Speaking in Arabic, KG says the youth took her mobile phone, ATM card, and her national identity card. KG says the president's order will lower the crime rate in Juba. President Kiir stresses that it is the primary responsibility of the government to protect citizens' properties and lives, and he can no longer allow criminals to loot and steal from innocent citizens. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The European Court of Human Rights has ruled that Italy violated the rights of migrants held on Lampedusa and in ships near Palermo by detaining them without clear and accessible legal basis. The court's ruling comes in the wake of a report by the Organization of International Migration that says over 7,000 migrants were killed or disappeared in 2016. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached reporter Josephine McKenna in the Italian capital, Rome.
Now, the court examined the case of 3 young men from Tunisia who had been held at a migrant reception centre on Lampedusa in 2011 before being deported back to Tunisia. And after their boats were intercepted by the Italian Coast Guard, the 3 men were taken to a reception centre. A violent kind of revolt took place at the centre and it was set on fire. 2 days later, the men were taken on ships near Palermo, where they were kept before they were being flown back to their country. Now, they alleged that their treatment was a violation of their liberty and that they suffered a speedy decision based on lawfulness of their detention, and they had failed to be fully informed of the reasons for the deprivation of their liberty. So several different issues there, and the court found in their favour.
These must have been the lucky ones, despite their human rights being violated. Who survived? There have been so many deaths this year on the high seas crossing to Europe.
That's right. And the Organization of International Migration has found that more than 7,000 migrants have been killed or disappeared in 2016. 60% of those deaths occurred on the Mediterranean, much higher than previously thought, and much higher than 2015. The figure last year was 5,700. In 2014, it was 5,200. Any death is a tragedy, but the number is so high, they're very, very concerned about this particular number this year.
The number is so high, but despite that, these deaths don't seem to have deterred the would-be migrants to Europe.
That's correct, and we've seen such a high number still coming in the last few months when the winter weather has started to settle in. We know that the conditions are much worse. Temperatures, colder, stronger winds, high waves, and yet people keep coming. We've just had a couple of thousand in the past week saved in the Mediterranean. Still this desperate push to reach Europe, mostly from Libya. So we're not really seeing a terrible slowdown as we would expect at this time of year. And that gives you a sense of how desperate people really are to get away from political persecution, poverty and conflict.
Now, given the determination of these migrants who would want to come to Europe, and given that the European Court of Human Rights has ruled against Italy to respect these human rights, how do countries like Italy balance the issue of human rights vis-a-vis protecting their borders and their immigration policies?
Well, it's a difficult question, and Italy has complained consistently to the European Union that the other European countries are not doing enough. Italy has seen more than 175,000 migrants arrive this year. The borders, as we know, have tightened up. Austria, Switzerland, France are making it much more difficult for people to move across the borders. And migrants have told me they feel that they don't want to stay in Italy. They don't want to seek asylum here. The number seeking asylum in Italy is quite low. They don't want to learn the language. Most of them want to move to France, Sweden, Germany, or the UK, where they may have relatives or see them a better future for themselves, because they really don't see a future in Italy. So getting that balance right is a real challenge for the Italian government, and ensuring that their rights are protected. And as we know, that's not always guaranteed, because their numbers are just so high at the moment.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Rome. Over 190 countries have signed to implement the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, to improve the lives of their people. Officially known as Transforming Our World, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development is a set of 17 aspirational global goals with 169 targets between them. Abu Miller, an independent ambassador for the sustainable achievement of the SDGs, told me Management 5.0 will be key in the effective implementation of the UN-sponsored Sustainable Development Goals.
The SDGs are basically 17 goals meant to be used to make the world a better place for all. Now, looking at the 17 goals, if we want to apply Management 5.0, Management 5.0 to it, it means that we want to find ways and means to avoid waste, ignorance, and greed in the achievement of these 17 goals. And in Management 5.0, if we apply the five principles, principle number one talks about, to achieve a better world, we need to avoid waste, ignorance, and greed in everything we do. And therefore, if we have to achieve the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, we need to avoid waste, ignorance, and greed in the implementation and achievement of those goals. And to avoid waste, ignorance, and greed in whatever we do, we have to pass the issue through 10 steps.
With these that you've mentioned, 193 countries adopted the UN Sustainable Development Goals to implement it to better the lives of their citizens.
Yes.
Now, how can one use Management 5.0, as you have described, to be beneficial for the people of those countries?
Before we can use Management 5.0 to implement the achievement of the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, we need even to know what Management 5.0 is all about. Management 5.0 is the act and science of avoiding waste, ignorance, and greed in everything we do. And it is made up of 10 elements. And the elements are what can then be used to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. And what are these elements? The first element is about defining whatever you want to do. The second element is about the overall aim of Management 5.0, which is to make the world or society a better place for all. And I think that is exactly what the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals are meant to do. They are meant to make the world a better place for all.
Now, so Abu, tell me, there's a new theory or thinking about the future of management. What are your thoughts?
We think that there are four issues that have come to play in the world. And if we want to take account of them, then we have to reposition management. What are these four things we are talking about? One is about the way the population is increasing. The world population is increasing so fast, and we cannot continue to use traditional or conventional management principles to sustain human progress. The second one is about the human being, as we know it today, has become very knowledgeable, very powerful, very demanding, and very impatient. And we cannot continue to use traditional or conventional management concepts to look for progress. The third aspect prevailing in the world is the fact that science and technology is advancing so much, and a lot of things that we could not do years ago are things that we can do with ease now. So in the light of all these things, we need to reposition management, which traditionally has all been about planning, organizing, leading, and control, to something more expanded. It must cover a large span.
Abomela is an independent ambassador for the sustainable achievement of the SDGs. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
You make me lose control. I'm loving. The way you moving your body from left and right, you own somebody. Look at the men, them look at you. Everybody just feeling you. Just feeling you. You go like to the Balaga. Chop in the banana. Come on, chop in the banana.
Oh, my mama.
Oh, Johnny.
Yeah. kungenjan ini ni hemi chagoni soma moyo kungenjan akalin dara muka kungenjan ini ni hemi chagoni soma moyo kungenjan
Oh, yeah, dancing in the void. Hey, I like, I like. dance to do the very well. Baby, would you know why?
Chango kila siku zangu wana owana.
Kwa nini nitoe michango kila siku zangu wana owana?
She's supposed to be my wife. She's supposed to be happy. She's supposed to have my ring. She's supposed to have me wedding. Ananipenda vile sidanandi. Ananipenda vile misidangi. Ananipenda vile sokinenga. Ananipenda vile misidangi.
Ananiliwaza kwa mziki mzuri toka sokiweka. Ananikonga.
And that was music from our African collection. Thanks to Douglas Impuga and the rest of the Nightline team for holding the fort while I was away on assignment out of the country. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the one and only Al Santos. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if your only tool is a hammer, you will see every problem as a nail. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 18th, we celebrate International Migrants Day, an occasion when we reflect upon the many ways that migrants enrich our cultures, economies, and societies, while also calling for greater respect for the human rights of all migrants. Perhaps like no other time in modern history, the world is on the move, with over 232 million migrants crossing national borders in 2015 to seek jobs, join families, study, invest, and contribute cutting-edge research. Migrants come from and travel to all corners of the globe, and migration represents an inexorable process that began long before current borders were drawn and will continue far into the future. Most migration is routine and includes temporary workers, international students, and expatriate residents. Migrants make important contributions both to their countries of destination, where they fulfill critical labor shortages, and countries of origin, where their remittances fuel economic growth. Migrants' contributions in the United States are striking. More than 40% of our high-tech companies have been founded by immigrants or their children. The list includes Google, eBay, and Intel. First and second-generation immigrants have won 65% of U.S. Nobel Prizes and account for one-third of our physicists, engineers, and doctors, 60% of our construction workers, and the majority of agricultural workers. Migrants to the United States take risks, work hard, invest, and innovate. Unfortunately, heated political rhetoric has all too often obscured the benefits and exaggerated the risks of migration. All countries should work to dispel unfounded fears and counter xenophobia. Regardless of their legal status or nationality, migrants should be treated humanely. Our own nation is built upon migrants' dreams. Their daring, their striving, and their freedom to imagine a better future has fueled our own prosperity and become an indispensable part of our heritage and national character, said Secretary of State John Kerry. The United States is a nation that has offered freedom and opportunity to migrants from around the world, and we hope the international community will work to make migration safer, more orderly, and more lawful for the benefit of all. All countries should seek to share the American migration experience, which has shown that our nation, economy, and society is stronger due to our ability to welcome all forms of migrants to our shores. At the same time, the United States reaffirms its commitment to assisting the world's vulnerable migrants and to working toward safe, orderly, and regular migration policies for the benefit of all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.